Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. We've got a discussion on the contemporary Labor Party with two highly qualified people to speak on it. We'll start off with the Honourable Dr. Meredith Bergman, who, of course, was an academic at Macquarie University for a couple of decades. She entered the Legislative Council and became the President of the Legislative Council in New South Wales, and she's shortly to put out a book of memoirs on the 60s, coming out later in the year. And the Honourable Dr. Craig Emerson, who was a former advisor, economic advisor to Bob Hawke. He was a minister in the Rudd and Gillard governments, and of course co-chair of the Review of Labor's 2019 federal election campaign document. So we're going to lead off with Dr. Bergman, followed up with Dr. Emerson, and we'll go to questions and discussion. Let's start. Many thanks, Meredith.
I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we are here today on the land of the Gadigal and pay tribute to their elders. And you're going to give me a 10-minute...
Yes, sir. Well,
yes. My talk will be a bit episodic because, but I have given a longer written version to Anne, so it will be on the site. And I assume I'm here as a speaker from the left of the Labor Party and also someone who's been in it a very long time, even longer than Craig. I've been in the Labor Party 50 years. Yes, I think I... you have no idea how much I deserve a clap for that. The Labor Party, you know, was formed really 130 years ago. It's the oldest party in Australia and one of the oldest political parties in the world. And it's really good that we're having a look at, you know, a bit of an audit of how it's going at the moment, especially at a time when the gap between rich and poor is widening in Australia. We're one of the very few OECD countries where the minimum wage relative to the average wage is actually going down. And historically, Labor is the party which has looked after people. It's given us the widow's pension, Medicare, no-fault divorce, OH&S legislation, the Sex Discrimination Act, Medicare, compulsory superannuation, NDIS. You could go on. There are a myriad number of things that you can be proud of if you're in the Labor Party. There are also a whole lot of things that make you squirm. And I remember in 1984, when Brian Burke, the Premier of Western Australia, you know, stymied our national land rights legislation, I was so disappointed and distraught about that, I thought I would leave the party, and I didn't quite get round to it. And I remember thinking, well, I didn't get around to it after that, so I'll probably stay in it forever. And that's sort of also the mindset of the true believer. You just stay in the party and you believe in it, but it doesn't make you uncritical. Now, I think my comments about the party are very different now to what they would have been 3 months ago. The summer from hell for Scott Morrison has meant that he has been transformed. He's no longer the great leader who brought the Liberals the miracle of the election result. He's no longer the likeable dad from the Shire ScoMo. He's now Scotty from marketing. And if that sticks, you know, he's in a bit of trouble. Because if you look at the last couple of months of voting intentions, you can see that there has been a bit of a change in the way Australians are looking at issues of about the climate and environment, and also about the leadership of the country. In January, voters said for the first time that climate change concerns them most. They put it above other important things like, I think, education and welfare. And the news poll that came out today, even though there was a closing of the way in which they thought about the leaders, also has voters prioritising climate action over energy prices for the first time. And significantly, Anthony Albanese is still the preferred Prime Minister, very close, 41 to 40, and Labor is still the party that would win an election at the next election, peaking too early, yes. However, I'll leave in-depth discussion about the election to Craig. I've read the review he did with Jay Weatherill, and it's an excellent document, but rather sobering. However, what I do want to look at is what effect did the election results have on the party? Not why we lost, but what's happened. I've been in the party 50 years, and I know when we're in trouble. I've been to meetings where people couldn't raise their heads, let alone their voices. Yet I went to a left meeting immediately after the election result, and it was packed to the rafters, and there was an air of excitement in the room. People felt energised by the result. And of course, the main thing to come out of the election is a change of leader. The takeout from Craig's review is that Shorten did not resonate. He was an unpopular leader, and our new leader is not unpopular. However, he is to some degree unknown. Albo is very popular with the rank and file, which gives him a lot of political capital. It means he can take the rank and file with him if he has to make difficult decisions. People in the party, even from the right, trust his political judgment and his strategic thinking. The leader of the so-called Otis group, Joel Fitzgibbon, is actually a friend and someone who does respect Albo as a leader. So to see that restaurant table at the Otis restaurant as somehow a faction is to totally misread the tea leaves. An interesting thing about Albo as leader is that for the last 5 years, he was being promoted by the Murdoch media. Now, I know this was a strategy by Murdoch to unsettle Shorten. So, of course, you promote Albo as leader, and it was done in quite unsubtle ways. But the interesting thing is, now that Albo actually is the leader, the Murdoch press is still being quite kind to him, and Albo is still writing material for the Murdoch papers, and it is very different to the vicious relationship between Murdoch and Bill Shorten. The other thing you need to know about Albo is that he is the master of the long game. Don't ever think that he's doing something for something that will happen in 2 weeks' time or even the next day. He's thinking 2 years ahead and sometimes even 10 years ahead. He's also the best arguer I've ever had to deal with. He's very irritating. He always has a comeback line. And he's not a bully, but he always gets the last word. And he actually genuinely believes in changing people's minds by arguing with them. And I must admit, I've changed my position on a number of things simply because he has argued with me about it. He's also genuine, and the capacity not to look shifty is an invaluable personal trait. And the members are actually enthused by having him there as a leader. Another thing that I want to say is don't underestimate the shock of the loss on the left of the party. Even my lefty friends now accept that we need to win back seats in Queensland before we can achieve government and actually do anything about climate change. We want there to be action on climate change, but we also recognise we've got to win those seats, or else we're leaving it up to Scott Morrison to and Barnaby Joyce to bring about action on climate change. Coal, of course, is the issue. I'm sure Craig will talk about this. And if we don't take totally correct position on coal, we will be, you know, attacked by the Greens. But in a federal election in Australia, the Greens have nowhere to go because it is compulsory preferential voting. It's compulsory voting, so they can't just stay at home the way people who don't like Trump are going to do. They're just going to stay at home. So they can't stay at home, and when they do go out to vote, they have to eventually decide between the Coalition and Labor. And there is actually very minimal leakage from the Greens. So we might find that we get attacked from our left, but we do accept that those votes eventually come back to us. And of course, even Greens accept that Bob Brown's convoy up north was just a total disaster. I mean, the optics of it were terrible. He came up from down south to tell the Northerners how to behave, and everyone knows that Queenslanders and people from the Northern Territory hate shit stirrers from down south, which is exactly what they were. Fall-in party membership, I don't particularly regard that as a problem. All mass organisations are losing members. I think we need to rethink branches. In the old days, that was the way it was organised, and it was organised because there wasn't good transport, there was no interconnectedness via the internet, the women weren't in the wage workforce, with the result that we still have our meetings at 8 o'clock on a weeknight, because that's when the bloke used to be able to come out, go down to his local pub where the meeting was, while the wife who'd just cooked him dinner, you know, put the kids to bed. It's just not a model that can work anymore. I think the Lavarch report into the New South Wales branch is very good, and if we carry out those recommendations, we will get a much better culture. One of the problems that the New South Wales branch had was that for 40 years, people had just been promoted through the ranks in the branch, so no one was coming in from outside. And also, they were simply setting themselves up to get a seat in the Senate or a seat in the New South Wales upper house. So there was really no push for them to actually be good administrators and run a good office. We need a proper management culture. I've just been on a 3-person panel to review the way we elected our leader just after the last election. Remember the vote between Chris Minns and Jodie Mackay? I've been for the last 6 months on that panel, and the thing that came out of that was how much the membership loved having a vote. It was really important to them. We're the most democratic party in Australia. Even the Democratic Greens don't elect their own leader with a rank and file vote. We've also experimented with primaries, and a few years ago we had a primary where 5,500 members of the public voted in a Labor pre-selection. Another thing we don't really... And I think we should talk more about our democratic processes inside the party. Another thing we don't really boast about enough is our affirmative action successes. Half of parliamentary members are now women in federal and the states. And the coalition is sitting at about 25% instead of 50%. I do touch on our issues with immigrant communities, and I'd like to just in passing say how disappointed I've been that both parties weren't protective enough of the Chinese community during the recent attacks on them being all Chinese spies, and now they're all, you know, carriers of disease. I do think xenophobia has been rife in the last year, 2 years. I'm very supportive of our strong relationship with the trade union movement, and I think that when media commentators say that, oh, it's the union donations which means that the Labor Party will always, you know, support union legislation. It's nothing to do with donations. It's because the people who are there as party members in the caucus believe that we should be passing legislation which protects workers' rights. I just think the whole idea of somehow, you know, donations changing the votes is very silly. I suspect I'm now towards the end. Oh, okay. I'll just say there are outliers in the party that have terrible views, we know this, on women, abortion, refugees and so on, but every party has their crazy drunken uncles. We had Mark Latham and Joe De Bruin. The Coalition have Craig Kelly and George Christensen, and the Greens have the anti-vaxxers and the anti-fluoride flat earthers. So no one can really be sanctimonious about strange people in their party. And Labor is the only government that can deliver any sensible policy on carbon emissions because it actually believes that climate change is real. Thank you.
Craig Emerson, thank you.
Straight into it, Mr. Chairman.
Yep.
I too would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. George Orwell has provided some useful advice for me and many others. Never use a metaphor, simile or other figure of speech which you aren't used to seeing in print, and never use a long word where a short one will do. So in speaking about the prospects and of the Labor Party, I'm not going to go to try and sell you a pig in a poke or I'm not going to go into too much programmatic specificity either. I want to tell you instead a story, not a narrative, but a story, because George said. When we were doing this review, Jay was feeding views into me and paragraphs, and we obviously knew that we had to do an executive summary. But as Jay continued to do that, the executive summary did expand and expand and expand. And then right towards the end, Jay rang me up and he said, "Mate, I think we need an executive summary." We've got an executive summary, he said, "but it's too long. It's too long." So I looked up the phrase in a nutshell because I wanted to summarise the whole report, which runs to 92 pages. And I looked it up because I knew that it was a metaphor and that George Orwell wouldn't be happy with me. So I was trying to think of something that would do the job of in a nutshell. And this was it. So I am going to read you literally 500 words because it is a summary of the report. I'm sure 95% of you will have read the entire report, but for the other 5%. I don't normally read stuff, but I think this is worth it. Labor lost the election because of a weak strategy that could not adapt to the change in Liberal leadership, a cluttered policy agenda that looked risky, and an unpopular leader. Now, one of these shortcomings was decisive, but in combination, they explained the result. Indeed, Bill Shorten led a United Party, saw off two Liberal Prime Ministers and won all three campaign debates. Labor's tax policy did not cost the party the election, but the size and complexity of Labor's spending announcements totalling more than $100 billion drove its tax policies and exposed Labor to a coalition attack that fuelled anxieties among insecure low-income couples in outer urban and regional Australia that Labor would crash the economy and risk their jobs. I'll now interpolate that they are the voters that Scott Morrison described as the quiet Australians. The Labor Party has been increasingly mobilised to address the political grievances of a vast and disparate constituency, working people experiencing economic dislocation caused by technological change will lose faith in Labor if they do not believe the party is responding to their needs, instead being preoccupied with issues not concerning them or that are actively against their interests. A grievance-based approach can create a culture of moving from one issue to the next, formulating myriad policies in response to a broad range of concerns. Care needs to be taken to avoid Labor becoming a grievance-based organisation. Low-income workers swung against Labor. Labor's ambiguous language on Adani, combined with some anti-coal rhetoric, devastated its support in the coal mining communities of regional Queensland and the Hunter Valley. On the whole, people of faith did not desert Labor, but Labor lost some support among Christian voters, particularly devout first-generation migrant Christians. Other religious denominations did not swing decisively one way or the other. This was based on a reasonably sophisticated statistical analysis that I did with someone in the party office. Higher income urban Australians concerned about climate change swung to Labor, despite the effect Labor's tax policies on negative gearing and franking credits might have had on them. There is no compelling evidence that the election loss was an adverse reflection on Labor's core values, improving the job opportunities, security and conditions of working Australians, fairness, non-discrimination on the basis of race, religion and gender, and care for the environment. Labor should retain these values. Its policies can be bold, but should form part of a coherent Labor story, be limited in number and easily explainable, making them less capable of misrepresentation. Labor should position itself as a party of economic growth and job creation. Labor should adopt the language of inclusion, recognising the contribution of small and large businesses to economic prosperity, and abandon derogatory references to the big end of town. Labor's policy formulation should be guided by the national interest, avoiding any perception of capture by special interest groups. Finally, a modern Labor Party cannot neglect human-induced climate change. To do so would be environmentally irresponsible and a clear electoral liability. Labor needs to increase public awareness of the costs of inaction on climate change, respect the role of workers in fossil fuel industries, and support job opportunities in emissions-reducing industries while taking the pressure off electricity prices. That's it. That's the 500 words. I just wanted to share that with you so that we're working from a common information base. Is the Labor Party in good shape? Yes, I think it is. Any party can always improve and always can learn from the past and from errors made. If you look at the Labor Party over its 130 years, just some of its achievements are Medicare, compulsory superannuation, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, needs-based school funding, the World Heritage listing of Tasmanian forests of Kakadu and of the wet tropic forests of North Queensland, the protection of Shelburne Bay, which was a brilliant environmental treasure of brilliant white sand that was to be exported overseas and converted into glass. And of course, that's four icons. The fifth, Antarctica. Bob Hawke, and I was pleased to be able to be with him and advise him all the way, led the charge against the mining convention being signed for Antarctica, and as a result of that, at least 50 years and probably indefinitely, there will be no mining in Antarctica. So they are big reforms, frankly. Most of those, not all, are resisted by the coalition, and there were promises to undo Medicare, to tear it right apart, to take a scalpel to Medicare. Superannuation, compulsory superannuation, has been under attack periodically and probably is yet again. And I didn't, of course, mention the big economic reforms, the whole reorientation of the Australian economy away from one shrinking, lacking confidence behind high tariff barriers and just buying and selling stuff to each other, essentially, with a few bit of iron ore and coal and a bit of wool. Tearing those barriers down and believing, rightly, that we could be confident in the world and particularly in the Asian region. Bob Hawke foresaw the growth of Asia and most particularly China, and I again was able under the Gillard government to be the architect of the white paper on Australia in the Asian century. Many of those reforms, particularly the tariff reforms and so on, were actually supported by John Howard as opposition leader, but not all, for example, fringe benefits tax, capital gains tax, but there was some bipartisanship around that big economic reform program. Now, Labor didn't do everything, even though it is the Progressive Party and the Party of Change. Malcolm Fraser, he was a pretty strong environmentalist, actually, and he put Kakadu Stage 1 on the World Heritage List, just as an example. He welcomed and organised for Vietnamese refugees to come into this country. He was absolutely and totally opposed to apartheid. So we think he did good things. John Howard did something that a Labor government could never have done, and that is introduced gun laws. Absolutely, enormously courageous, and Tim Fisher passed away recently, and what a legacy we have to those two for those gun laws. In fact, Barack Obama said not so long ago there are three things that he would like for America, love for America, that Australia has: compulsory voting, so they don't have to spend all this time on getting voters to turn out, Medicare and gun laws. And I think most people in this room would probably think that's a pretty good list. But, you know, in truth, most of the really big changes have been Labor changes. You know, I would say that anyway, but I think objectively it's true. But one of the real problems that we saw in that 500-word summary was the high expectation of a Labor win, and we called it banking the win. And I'm just going to warn here about interest group politics. Because everyone thought we were going to win, including the betting agencies, who actually paid out on the Thursday before the ballot. Everyone was so confident that I understand quite rationally what all of the progressive interest groups were doing. They went to Labor and said, oh, we better get a commitment to this now, because after the election, Labor will be too busy with its 240 policies implementing those. And so one after the other, in this great effort at alliance building, Labor said yes, 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 and there were 240 policies costing $100 billion. Mind you, I've just mentioned this in passing, that wouldn't have blown the budget, because the revenue measures were bigger than the spending measures and would have fully covered those costs and led to a return to surplus and a better budget bottom line. But I guess a lot of that got lost in the in the campaign and in the fury of the campaign. So I just wanted to mention that in the Labor Party we now have a lot of groups who, if they are there for the Labor Party and have an interest in a particular thing, absolutely fine. But if they're in the Labor Party only because of that interest that they have, whether it would be in, you know, so even the environment, people I'm quite close to, the Labor Environmental Action Network, you want them to be also interested in the rest of the Labor Party. Labor for Refugees, you want them also to be interested in the rest of the Labor Party, LGBTQI groups and so on. And I think that one of the problems is that people saw that language that we were speaking about, interest groups, special groups, and they're saying, yeah, but I know I'm not special, but I still get to vote. The truth is, elections are actually won in the centre. That's where most of the undecided votes are. And you know, all of those quite worthy causes can be pursued in government. And I'm not saying they shouldn't be advocating, but I think Labor needs always to realise, as Hawke and Keating did, that elections are determined in the centre. And Meredith was talking about the Greens. The Greens actually, arguably more vociferous opponents of Labor than they are of the Coalition, because they compete with Labor for seats, right? So the political party, the Greens, who I regard as distinct from the environment movement, the Greens actually prosper when they attack Labor. And, you know, don't worry as much about the Coalition. So Labor shouldn't try to be the Greens. Let them do what they want to do. As Meredith said, without taking it for granted, not too many Greens were going to be recommending how to vote preferences for the Coalition, because that would damage them. So we just need to be conscious about moving towards the centre.
Pretty well wrote on.
And one final, sure. Mr. Chairman. The democratisation of the Labor Party, or of any party, sounds fantastic. But let's understand what we're talking about when we're talking about democratisation by referring to one example of people being invited into the party to select the leader. And that example is Jeremy Corbyn. As most people would have expected, Labour got smashed in the UK because if you paid £5, you're in the Labour Party. Well, I don't know if it's one of the greatest branch stacks of all time, but the fact is Jeremy Corbyn had the support of the branch membership. He put forward a very revolutionary, I don't mean that in a derogatory way, program, and people said no, because the centre said no. So I'm not talking about left and right here, I'm just talking about there are pitfalls in saying, look, just you all join the Labour Party, whether you've got a Labour tradition or Labour values, and it'll all work out well. It often doesn't. So, finally, climate change. I did say, and we said in the report, we should not turn our backs on climate change. There's a big debate going on now. There's a fantastic opinion piece in the Financial Review, just been published, I think, that I might have written. but it actually does say that zero net emission by 2050 is achievable. This is a debate that we should have. We can transform the economy. There can be a lot more jobs coming out of that approach than clinging on to every single job, which Australia has never been able to do in its history anyway. So I think that there's a big debate to be had. The debate's happening right now in Canberra, and as far as I'm concerned, bring it on. Thank you very much.
Emerson and Meredith Bergman. So we come to questions and discussions. So have you both come up here?
Yep.
And you're talking to the microphone, and we'll be away. So just... No, you've got to come up here. You've got to stand up. Yeah. Stand up. So we're talking to the microphone. So we'll just start off. You both referred to this, but... the concept of the top end of town, it was used by Bill Shorten, but it was also used by Wayne Swan and the current Shadow Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, and some others. But as Aaron Patrick points out in a book, in his recent book, the only group that swung to Labour were the top 20% of wage earners. So if you're attacking a group that then votes for you, it would give a pretty clear indication that you really missed the group that was in northern Tasmania, western Sydney, Queensland north of Brisbane. Somehow that lower income groups didn't adapt to that slogan, so...
Maybe we should attack more groups.
Meredith, you got...
Look, I think it was very interesting the way so much of it was divided along education lines. Where I was handing out at Forest Lodge Public School, where I've handed out for yonks, we got a 16% swing to us. So we went home all really happy.
Forest Lodge?
Inner city Sydney.
Oh, yeah, it's a new suburb, isn't it? It's near Sydney Uni.
No, it's a very old suburb.
Was it always called?
It's always called Forest Lodge, but it is absolutely, you know, half the parents at the School of Professors and things.
Yeah,
so,
right.
And it was a 16% swing to them. So it was quite clear that issues like climate change were, and our tax policies, which were understood and appreciated by those groups, really appealed to people who understood them. But I, you know, it was quite clear. My sister said to me, oh, I'm going to lose all this money on, you know, franking credits refund. And I said, you don't get any franking credits refund. You know, nobody understood it. And we lost a huge amount of votes because of that, anyway.
Okay, so we've got to be brief with your comments and questions. Yep, there.
I'll be brief. Oh, where's the button? Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Right, Queensland question. Townsville, no. Mackay, Rockhampton, and Gladstone.
Right. Let's just go.
I'll start again. Queensland question.
Yeah.
Townsville, Mackay, Rockhampton, Gladstone. They're all state Labor seats. Federally, Why can't Labor win those same electorates from North Queensland down to New Beath near Logan?
Well, Labor has won all of those.
Not federally?
Yes, it has.
But not this last election?
No, it hasn't won the state seat because it's a federal election, but it's won the seat of Herbert, it's won the seat of... Sorry?
No, but what he means is you didn't win these seats
this time. You said why can't. Yeah, okay. I thought you said why can't they, and I'm just saying...
No, why didn't they last?
Okay.
Well, we've heard about the... And I'm not going to blame Bob Brown for everything, you know. Everyone goes, oh, well, it was a Murdoch media, it was this, it was that. We would, if Bob Brown hadn't done that, I don't think we would have won the election, right? But it didn't help. So we did lose, as you say, Herbert, Capricornia, which we hadn't held, Flynn, which we hadn't held, but we had held Herbert because preferences came from One Nation the previous time. And One Nation changed and gave preferences to the coalition. And same all the way down to Bundaberg. So, look, it was one of those things where the coalition was effective in saying, you're all going to lose your jobs, Labor doesn't care about you. I was talking about, you know, the language that gets used from time to time. Messages are received that weren't intentionally sent. You know, it's just... You can't... I think next time there'll be a wiser approach to those seats, but the swings were very big as well, so the challenge will be great. But we have... Labor has held them before. I think Leichhardt is a seat that could easily change hands at the next election.
You want to comment on
that? Okay. Just a question here.
The last time you won a federal majority was indisputably on the back of your Rights at Work campaign. Arguably, there's just as much insecure employment today as there was in 2007. Wages growth is lower. Why weren't you able to convert those issues into a win?
Well, that's a very good question, if I might say. Your Rights at Work was based on work choices, which is a very concrete piece of legislation. And it had been said to me back then that 1 million people decided that changed their vote over that issue. You don't see the government, the coalition, talking a lot about work choices anymore. I think the answer to the question is that while you're right about the rising insecure work and so on, they didn't believe Labor would provide secure work. Right? There wasn't a piece of legislation where that would be all credible where, say, Labor said, vote Labor and you'll all have full-time jobs, or vote Labor and the boss will never be able to sack you. So people are quite smart about that, and I'm glad Labor didn't seek to make completely false promises, because I think people are starting to think that it's bad in many cases, not always, but bad in many cases, but what role can government realistically play in kind of guaranteeing secure work and so on. So, you know, governments can't do everything, and I think that that's probably the answer to your question. I'm glad Labor didn't actually say, we're going to fix all your problems for you.
I think that insecure work, wage theft, and the fact that wages just haven't moved for 5 or 6 years is going to become a much more important aspect of the next election than it was in this one.
Yeah.
There's a question here.
Thank you both for the talk. Where do you think you unearth the next Hawke or Keating? Because I suspect you'll need one of those as a leader to get...
No, not necessarily. I think leaders, once they become Prime Minister, take on an aura of, you know, they're great. Now, I'm not in the Liberal Party, as you might have ascertained, but you might recall, and Gerard would, Alexander Downer was the leader of the opposition in 1995, and Alexander said some silly things and he was gone. And the Liberal Party scratched their heads. Who are we going to get to become the leader? Who are we going to get? And then someone said, what about John Howard? And others would have said, nah, well, let's give him a go. And they gave him a go as Prime Minister for 11 years. So I don't think you need these sort of towering figures in order to be elected. And I really think the Australian people, as Bob Hawke, you know, don't ever underestimate the intelligence of the Australian people. They're not looking for a rock star. They're not looking for Mr. or Mrs. Charisma. They're just looking for someone who is authentic.
Question here.
The Labor Party is generally regarded as the better campaigning team. So if all these things were so obvious after the election, why weren't they so obvious before the election? Or did you just believe the polls like everyone else seemed to?
Yeah, I think the last part of your question is the answer. We have a whole section in the report under the heading "The Role of Expectations," and you know, you're running onto the field and you're red hot favourite, and everyone behaves as if you're the red hot favourite, and so there was probably a lack of attention to detail in some of these areas, and the most striking one was in social media, the digital media. That amazingly Labor had an advantage on that in 2016, and by 2019 it had a deficit. This, I'll just finish on this, this is not unusual. I've been around so long that there was this innovation called a fax machine, and Labor started faxing out stuff to people, and then they came on this other really good idea called direct mail, where you'd put, you know, a computer would spit out thousands of these with a blue signature and a little PS. And of course the Liberals caught up on those very, very quickly. It's whenever you get a technological advantage, the other side obviously picks it up. Labor had an advantage in digital, kind of relaxed, and the Coalition came in and just went bang and smashed Labor on Facebook in particular.
I actually think that the fact that the polling got it so wrong was incredibly important in the way the campaign was run. For instance, we were saying, this is not going right, this is blah, blah. And all that we kept getting back from head office was, oh, it's okay, we're going to win.
Yeah.
So I think it was those poll... I mean, I think the really interesting question was, how did the polling get it so wrong? Because, and I've read all the stuff about it, and no one's really properly explained that.
But the Liberal Party says their internal polling didn't get it wrong. They say the last 2 weeks their internal polling got it right.
Well, our internal polling said the same.
Well, our tracking polling said that there was a problem for Labor. But there is, frankly, some revisionism, because Liberal ministers were convinced that they were going to lose. I'm not saying there was no one, such as Andrew Hirst in the party office, who was saying we're a chance here. But I know Liberal staffers were ringing up looking for jobs, for example.
Matthias Cormann was pretty confident.
I was about to say, I think it was his staff that was ringing up looking for jobs.
I was one of the few people that predicted the result, but then again, I'm in Wentworth, so that is a foregone conclusion.
Right. Not quite.
No, it was. Okay. I think the problem with Labor was not only the head of the party organisation, but a lot of the supporting groups, because anyone with faith in that, they just seemed to rubbish. And that really put people like me off, and also the franking credits, because that would have affected me. And if they'd have got in, I'd have liquefied all that and just put the money elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, when I say it was closer than expected, you know, we're talking about the betting agencies. I followed them every week, and I kept a tabulation, and Dave Sharma in Wentworth was so far ahead of Karen Phelps the whole time, and I think he got 53% in the end. So it actually was closer than I thought. But the point is that, you know, about groups that come in as progressive groups and therefore self-identify, or other people identify them as Labor. We saw that with the Adani thing. And again, the Liberals did a smart thing. They basically said, that's Labor. They put Labor people on the posters as saying that sort of stuff, or the Adani, even though it was Bob Brown from the Greens Party. But another group is GetUp. And GetUp is always talking about an issue, one issue. And I think the whole language of exclusion, you see, when you talk about one issue, you're not talking about the rest. And this is where Scott Morrison did well. He wasn't talking about single issues. He was saying, had a message for everyone. But for better or worse, richer or poorer, partly because of those sorts of groups, the information that was coming to people was that, oh, they're for interest groups, but they're not for us.
You want to add to that?
Oh, I'd also say that I'm finding it very interesting finding out, you know, week after week, how much of taxpayers' money was being spent on those marginal electorates by the Liberal Party through those various grant schemes. I mean, there's now another one that they seem to be using. And don't underestimate that. I've been involved enough to know that if the local hockey team gets $40,000 suddenly, they're very happy to vote for that member again.
Question here.
So, Meredith, we heard you very proudly speaking that Labour is the most democratic party, but then we also heard Craig saying that democracy is great except for when it comes to electing the leader of the party. Is there then a move to undo the Rudd Amendment within the Labour Party to just have a select group of people elect the leader, like establish a college of professors, as you mentioned, or you know, membership of 10-year duration so you can stop the brandstacking with the $5 entry fee?
He wasn't talking about brandstacking. He was talking about the British system,
exactly, so.
Where you don't have to be a member of the party to vote for the leader. I try and take the rank and file's right to vote for their leader away from them now, and there would be uproar. But I don't see anything wrong with it. I think they chose Jodie McKay, who was the right choice in New South Wales. They chose Albo, who was the right choice now. And don't forget that it's always half and half. The caucus still has half of the vote, and the rank and file have the other half.
So the Rudd Amendment, Craig, you might just explain that. You're talking about the caucus amendment, right?
To be perfectly candid, both the Rudd Amendment and the Morrison Amendment, just to explain them, I think maybe they're the same. Need something like 3/4 of the party room to agree that there will be a ballot. Right? Now, I'm just going to say this. That rule has been made by the party room. That rule can be unmade by the party room. Right? So there's this kind of, okay, this is now, you know, chiselled in the Ten Commandments that you need. If there were a circumstance, it's easy for me to talk about the Liberal Party, if there were a circumstance where people, a majority, right, and I'm not predicting it, I'm just saying, a majority said, Scott Morrison, we don't want you to be the leader of the Liberal Party, I think that would be it, because you're sitting there saying, well, hold on, a majority don't want me, but you need to have 75% who don't want me. It's just not plausible, and people would go to him and say it's all over.
There's a question there, isn't there? Yeah.
Earlier, one of the gentlemen here commented on the a previous trade union campaign to help Labor get into power federally. Can you comment on the role of the trade union movement and their campaign during the last election?
Sure. I talked to the senior leadership of the union movement, and in a sense, they were doing their best, and they put in a massive effort, but perhaps there could have been a better... let's think of banking the win. The campaign was change the rules. It wasn't change the government. It was change the rules. If the campaign had been change the government, it might have been a bit more effective. But change the rules meant to deal with some of these issues about insecure employment and so on, fine, but it was more a campaign for what the union movement would want in government. And I think that's a lesson for the trade union movement. If GetUp wants to listen to it, that would be a lesson for them, you know, for these groups and I'm now going on to the community-based organisations rather than the union movement. If they do want to change the government, maybe they should talk about changing the government rather than about their particular issue. Of course, use your issue and appeal, you know, whether it's animal welfare or whatever, but the whole purpose of it should be to get people to vote in a particular way.
You want to add to that?
Well, it really was about banking the win. So many groups just demonstrated against the Labor Party. You know, the Labor Party would be having a meeting and suddenly a stop Adani person holding a poster would appear in front of them. And I kept thinking, actually, we're not the government. Go off and do that to the Liberal Party. But those groups, like the Green Party and GetUp, were so convinced we were going to win. They were about changing our point of view rather than about, you know, changing the government.
Yeah. There's a question here.
As I see it, Labor's fighting on two fronts. He lost the two seats in Tasmania, lost seats in Northern Queensland, lost seats in lost Quincy and Western Sydney. And Michelle Rowland, your member, was saying before the election, as the election went on, that one of the problems in the west of Sydney is that you have a number of groups who have faith-based. They're immigrant groups, they're people who don't like the secular nature of some of the debates we've had recently. So how does Labor manage to keep the Greens from taking seats in the inner city where they vote heavily at Forest Lodge, and also appeal to what I think correctly Scott Morrison has termed the quiet Australians, who don't get on the ABC and don't sort of talk to the inner city suburbs? How do you kind of fight that two-front battle?
I think Meredith summarised it pretty well. No one's complacent about Green votes, but honestly, I might be a little bit down on the Greens. I don't know if you picked that up. But I was the head of the Environment Department in Queensland under Wayne Goss, and the Greens actually campaigned for the incoming Borbidge government in a number of vital seats. And then when it was down to one seat for a re-election Mundingborough, again, they would not support Labor. So no one's ever going to get me to say I love the Greens, right? And they do compete very hard. I think it's quite good that Anthony Albanese is the leader, because he is used to fighting the Greens for his seat. So he knows how to do it without, you know, I better not say pissing everyone else off, should I? But you know, like, there's still people who are progressive and concerned about the environment who vote Labor, right? Because he's that sort of brand. In terms of people of faith, I did more statistical analysis on this than anything else. And all we can do is draw lessons without them being absolutely true. You can just draw the best conclusions you can. The group, as I mentioned in that the group were very, very devoted Catholic groups. Obviously, Pentecostal churches, they tend to very much vote coalition, but who had just arrived recently, and they were in those western suburb seats, Chris Bowens, Tony Berg, Michelle Rowland, and so on. There could be a bit of an overreaction if people thought that all Catholics voted Liberal or anything like that.
I'm not even thinking Catholic.
I know you're not. I'm doing this for the audience. But we did have a good look at Hindus and Sikhs, could not find any pattern. Had a good look at Chinese voters, could not find any pattern. In the seat of Reid, Chinese voters swung against Labor. In the seat of Barden, they were fine. So, you know, this is why we put so much effort into this. It doesn't mean you can be complacent about it. Doesn't mean that there is a big drift away from particular ethnic groups, but the one kind of defining feature was recently from Northern Africa and the Middle East, who were devout Catholics, and or very Christian, maybe not all Catholics. But yes, and that was on the same-sex marriage issue.
Okay, the last reference was to Muslims, okay, in case it wasn't picked up. Yes?
Yeah, just getting back to the issue of the Greens and them fighting Labor for the seats. I think the Greens are pretty well stuck at one person in the lower house. If you look at the seats in Jed Carney's seat in Melbourne and Tanya and Albo in Sydney, they're actually increasing their majorities. And I don't think at the federal level there are any. There's one seat in Brisbane that could be a worry at the federal level. But really, that's all there is. And so the Greens are sort of stymied at the federal level. I think they may continue to win seats at the state level. But on the whole, where do they go if there's an issue about who do they support for government? They're still going to have to support the Labor Party. So, you know.
But before we go to the last question, I think the question was directed really at people who normally would have voted Labor but moved across to vote for Morrison. In Western Sydney, Northern Tasmania, parts of Queensland. not people who went to vote for the Greens.
That's well, no, there were two parts. There were two parts of the question, and I'm answering the first part of the question.
That's fine. Okay, now I think we're pretty well finished, but there's a question down the back.
Just a question. Really, I've sat here all night listening to self-interest. All the questions really delve around what people are interested in before they cast their vote. The guy in the front from Wentworth, for example, said he wouldn't vote for the Labor Party because of the franking credits. I'm in Wentworth as well. So, from both of you, and I'm also in the Labor Party, from both of you, where's the debate about the society where people are interested in the bigger picture of where this country is going? I haven't seen anything in the last hour of where we are going. That appears to be irrelevant.
Okay, we're going to wait here on where
I'd
we
ask
are
you
going.
To read my paper because I actually do talk about fairness, and fairness in taxation, I think, is the issue. And it was such a pity we lost that election because those policies that we went to the election, I admit we didn't sell them well, but they were fair, and they were fair to the people who needed it.
I'll answer in two parts. Obviously, fairness, health is a big issue, climate change is a really big issue. You can end up saying, well, it's all self-interested if you want, and therefore nothing qualifies as a, you know, big noble cause. But I think that there has been debate on all of those things. It's pretty clear that there are stark differences between Labor and the Coalition. That has not always been the case. But let me leave you with this thought. I wrote a piece on tribalism not long ago, caused a huge fuss with the Greens in particular. If you're in the outer suburbs, you're a couple, one working full-time, one working part-time, got children, getting them off to school, and every day, it's not terrible, but it's a struggle. And a party says, don't think of yourself, think of the nation. They say, it's my responsibility to think of myself, my family, my children. And I don't diminish that or criticise that in the slightest. You know, of course, with high-income earners, we ask them to do, and they do, because their jobs are more secure and they can think about other things, but when you're just slogging it out in the traffic, day in, day out, I don't think there's anything wrong with people saying, I'm going to look after our little tribe, which is called our family.
Many thanks. Gone longer, but it's on time, and it was a nice point on which to stop. So many thanks to both Craig Emerson and Meredith Bergman. We had an important look at the significant review of Jay Weatherill and Dr. Emerson that they two chaired, and then also Meredith Bergman's recent work in New South Wales Labor. And of course, Craig Emerson comes from a background that involves Queensland, now living in New South Wales, spent a lot of time in Canberra. Understands a lot of these issues very well, as does Meredith Bergman. So, look, thanks to both of you for a stimulating and a very informative talk tonight. And Craig's been here before, we'd love to have you back again. And Meredith is a first timer, we'd love to have you back again. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.